I am Hans.
And I am Franz, and we just want to pop
your
compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. Man, do I love spending time with you. Thank you. Thanks for spending time with me. Tell your friends about the program, please. Encourage them to download the Relevant Radio app. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If you get a busy signal, just keep hitting redial. Let's go back to the phones. Monica in Los Alamitos, California. It's good to have you on the program. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My question is about wearing masks in church. Okay. Our church recently opened this past Sunday for services inside the church. And beforehand, they sent out notification that if you're vaccinated, a mask is not required, but please wear a mask if you are not vaccinated. And I don't want to wear a mask, and I still want to go to church, mm-hmm. and I want to receive the Eucharist, but am I being sinful if I'm not wearing a mask?
No, I don't think you're being sinful. I have said before that I truly believe that these are exaggerated forms of protection that are way beyond what is actually necessary and beneficial. And I say this not simply as, you know, some guy with a microphone, but anecdotally, I've polled as many physicians as I can talk to about this over the last year or so. And you know, I see all of the comments from Dr. Fauci and others about how we have reached or nearly reached herd immunity. We've got a huge number, many millions of people in this country who have already had COVID, so they've got the natural antibodies. It doesn't seem to me that, from what I can tell, that there's a need for them to be vaccinated since they already have a natural immunity to this. And I've talked to doctors about that as well. So from what I can see, Monica, this is, and it's strange. I don't know why some people did hang on like grim death, but they are buying into this exaggerated, unnecessarily complicated measure of self protection. And all I can do is sometimes just shake my head. I don't know what else to say. But I do know that many parishes around the country don't have those exaggerated measures anymore, and people are doing just fine. You know, in the great state of Ohio where I live, that is not a requirement, nor has it been for quite some time. And people are just fine. And you're not seeing rampant transmission of COVID-19 to other people. So all I can do here is just simply commiserate with you and say, I wish it weren't this way. I wish these exaggerated extravagant measures were not being forced on people, but they are. So what can you do? You do the best you can. If you wanted to find a traditional Latin Mass community that's connected to your diocese, that's, you know, in the church, not a renegade group, that might be a place where you can go. And usually they have, you know, they don't have these exaggerated restrictions. So that might be one way to go about doing that. Another thing, and I certainly take this to heart myself as well, and that is, if you put on a mask, if you haven't been vaccinated and you put on a mask, that can be very good for your humility. And we all like to have our way followed. I like it when I get my way. And I'm not always happy when somebody else gets their way, when their way doesn't agree with my way. But this is a great way to cultivate humility and to take a weed whacker to one's pride by willingly doing something that you would otherwise not want to do. It's not going to harm you to wear your mask for an hour on Sunday. So I think there is some upside there. On the one hand, you can say, I wish it weren't this way, but it is this way. So you can do a little bit of self-purification or let God purify you more by humbly doing something that you would rather not do. I think that can be a very good thing from a spiritual standpoint. What do you think?
Hear what you're saying. I think, you know, for 9 months, I wore a mask to attend services that were outside. Mm-hmm.
Another gross exaggeration. Completely
right,
unnecessary.
And I mm-hmm. did it because I wanted to be in church in person or at mass in person. But I have issues with the mask that I think it's a sacrifice. It's kind of triggering to me, given some past experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's hard at points to deal with it. And I'm kind of done at this point.
And done with what?
I'd like to go to mass. Done with I feel like I have sacrificed by wearing the mask and trigger, you know, putting myself in uncomfortable situations in terms of reminders of past traumas and things like that, mm-hmm. that the mask triggers.
The mask triggers it, or wearing a mask? I want to make sure I heard you. The mask triggers it, or mass triggers it?
The mask. The mask,
okay.
When
okay.
being assaulted and being smothered, and I have to wear. I maybe people don't get it, but it is something mm-hmm. that.
Could you get a doctor's note saying that you have a medical reason not to wear a mask? I mean, that might work. I know somebody who has that.
Right. I just don't want to have to battle going into details about something that's very private.
Sure, understandable.
You're on the radio, but
yeah. No, I'm not asking you to divulge anything that's private. I'm just saying that if you had a sympathetic physician who could write you a note that says, because of this condition that you've got and the flashbacks and the triggering, that you have a medical reason not to wear a mask. I know somebody who has one of those, and that has helped him in similar situations. Something to think about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. But just remember this, Monica, and I know you know this, but maybe it's helpful to have somebody remind you. Jesus loves you, and he wants you to be happy. And sometimes the human, not sometimes, usually always, the human members of his body, the church, can make that difficult. But don't turn away from Jesus. Don't turn away from the mass. Don't become discouraged and walk away. Hang in there. You know, you hung in there for a year, and I think there's light at the end of the tunnel, and I really don't think that the mask thing is going to last that much longer. Knock on wood. I really don't. I think if you can just hang in there a little while longer, or maybe sit in the very back, you know, I'm sure if you talk to the parish priest and explain to him your background and things that have happened, he will find some way to accommodate you. You know.
Okay.
But don't walk away. Don't get discouraged. Okay? Hang in there.
Thanks.
You're welcome. All right. Well, we'll pray for you. Please pray for us too, Monica. 888-914-9149. Now we go to Brandon in Chicago. Love how many Chicago calls we get every single day on this program. Welcome, Brandon.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for your show and Relevant Radio. My wife and I listen often. I have a question and a theory that's been racking my brain for about the past week. You see on the program that God is outside of space and time, that he sees the past, present, and future all at once. You know, with that theory, I do have difficulty contemplating, understanding free will and the intercession of prayer. Mm-hmm. I had a theory, and, you know, humbly, you know, I'm sure many other people have had this theory that God is not outside of space and time, that he is in the present, but he can see all outcomes as his wisdom and intelligence is infinite, and he could see all possible variants of the future. I just want to see how that theory stacks up against church's teaching.
Yeah, well, I mean, the second part is authentic. I mean, it's true. God can see all possible outcomes. There was a debate in the around the time of the Council of Trent between the Dominicans and the Jesuits on a question of what's called scientia media, middle knowledge. What could God possibly know that is not real, but it's hypothetical? You know, like what possibly could have happened under a certain circumstance. And so there was an ongoing debate on that issue. It was known as Molinism. And that debate was never ultimately resolved. There were good points to be made on both sides, but eventually the Pope said, you know, knock it off, guys, stop arguing about this. So I want to bring that into this discussion to point out that great minds have been thinking about this issue for a long time. And because it is such an august mystery, we're not able to really plumb the depths of this, but we can know some things about this mystery. And one of the things we can say for sure, Brandon, is that anything that can be known, God knows. And he knows it from all eternity. He doesn't find out something. There's nothing that God could learn that he doesn't already know, and this from all eternity. So that's maybe the first step in answering your question. So if we can agree that God knows everything that can be known, then the question is, well, how does he know this? Does he know it by experience, or does he just know it? We know things by experience. But God doesn't know things by experience. He knows them because they can be known, and in anything that can be known, he knows. So that gets maybe to your issue about being outside of time and space. What that means is, because time is finite and space is finite, God must, by his very nature, be outside of those things. Otherwise, he himself would be constricted in some way by a finite thing, and that's impossible because God is infinite. So we can reason our way toward what this must mean to say that God is outside of time and space, because if he were, so to speak, trapped or within the universe, the physical universe, that would be a limit on him. And so we can rule that out as a possibility, because God is infinite. He's limitless in his knowledge, his truth, his beauty, his goodness, etc. Now, that's hard for us to understand. I mean, that's putting it lightly. It's virtually impossible for us to understand, because we have nothing else that we can point to in our experience that our senses have shown us that we could say, oh, it's like that, because there is nothing else like that.
We're a temporal being.
Precisely. We're temporal. We're in time. So when we talk about God, we use our puny human thought categories to try to explain it, and we do the best we can. But this would be an area, Brandon, you have two ways of demonstrating something is true or not true. So you have the apophatic and the cataphatic. Those are just fancy words from the Greek that means, in the case of an apophatic statement, you're describing what God is not. So you're eliminating things. God can't be this, he can't be that, he can't be this. Those are not positive statements of what God is, but they're narrowing down who God is by eliminating things that can't be true about God. God can't be limited, for example. God can't learn something he doesn't already know. The apophatic is where you say things that are positive about God. God is love, for example. God is all-powerful. These are those positive statements that identify some attribute of his. And that is kind of a dual process here when you're considering the nature of God. Some things you can rule out, other things you rule in because you know that they must be true about him. So I'm not trying to defeat your argument about God being inside of time and space. I'm just trying to show you how, when you really stop and think about it, it would be impossible, according to his nature, for God to be limited that way.
Like you said, I think it's very difficult for us to understand. And I know there's a scripture that does say, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. And in effect, that his thinking is above ours. And this is, like you said, many scholars have debated this issue and have not come to a resolution. And it's just, maybe there'll never be a resolution when to the afterlife. We may be enlightened.
You know, a good book for you, I recommend it a lot. It's called Theology and Sanity. It's brilliant.
Okay.
It's luminous, and it gets into all of these topics. It gets into what is the nature of spirit, what is the nature of matter, talks about God and his inner life, and it draws, of course, upon Scripture, but it's a very Thomistic way of looking at these things. And one of the great things about St. Thomas is that he brings a lot of light to these otherwise obscure issues. And Frank Sheed is a really good interpreter of St. Thomas in terms of expressing those deep ideas in a way that the 21st century modern American can understand, for people like you and me. So I have a feeling if you spend some time with this book, Theology and Sanity, and call me back in a month, you'll have a different view of things.
Okay, I'll definitely check it out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, Frank Sheed, you can't go wrong. The guy is flat out brilliant, And his book, Theology and Sanity, is published by our friends at Ignatius Press. Let's go now to Samantha in Michigan. Hi, Samantha.
Read that one on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. Governor Cuomo, he's not thinking. What stops other criminals from all over the world going over there, being a resident? I'm worried about people like our children, our young girls, our young men. Mm-hmm. I'm just worried that there's going to be too many criminals changing their sex and their identity.
And yeah, that's
and we're
a big
not going to
problem.
Know who they are.
It's a big problem. It's a big problem.
Is there any way that there's no way we can fight that? Is there? Because we don't live there.
Well, I mean, not being a resident of the state of New York, no, I can't vote in their local elections. I don't have that ability. I really don't know what kind of legal effort or pressure can be brought to bear. Maybe the federal government would have something to say about that. But our federal government, I mean, I don't know if I really even need to say this, but the federal government is in the tank for this kind of ideology. They're all over this stuff. They love this stuff. They can't get enough of this stuff. I mean, look at the military. Good heavens, our military is now being overrun with gender ideology and critical race theory. And you've got these generals and admirals fumbling all over themselves trying to defend why they're forcing sailors and soldiers and others to be indoctrinated with this stuff. So, I mean, you know, maybe if Dwight D. Eisenhower was still president, he might be able to step in and stop what's going on in New York. But it's everywhere now. So the best I can say is prepare yourself and your family and your children and your grandchildren and be knowledgeable and articulate and willing to stand up and speak the truth. Because I think now we've sort of reached the point where it's like house to house fighting now. It's person specific. It's not at the macro level anymore. These institutions have been so swamped by this tsunami, so inundated. And so many people who hold positions of authority and influence within these institutions, they're all into it. So now it's a matter of trying to help people on a person-specific basis. This is what I try to do on this program every day, is just try to help. I mean, think of it this way, Samantha, to use an analogy. Let's say that we're on the Titanic. I don't like to think about that, but let's say that we're on the Titanic as a country, as a culture. And we've already hit the iceberg and this thing is going down. I don't like to think about that. And I'm not saying that we are. I'm just saying if we could use this as a parallel example, well, what should we do then? I would say let's help as many people get to the lifeboats as possible. Let's help as many people be saved as possible. We can't save them all, but we can save as many as we can possibly, you know, reach. So if things are that bad off, some days I wonder, but if they're that bad off, then I say that's what you and I should be doing. You know?
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Keep listening, okay, Samantha? Stay plugged in with Relevant Radio. We're here to help. We really are. You know, tell your friends about us.
God bless you.
Thank you. You too. Let's go to a break and come right back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Okay. Hey, there's a cool picture. I posted it on my Twitter feed. At Patrick Madrid. Remember that scene in Gladiator where Russell Crowe, his character, has died or is dying, and he's walking through this wheat field toward his home in the afterlife, and his, you know, wife and son come running out to greet him. Remember that scene? Very evocative. Well, I posted a picture of that, but there's also a picture of a guy who's standing in the same place many years later. And it's just very interesting to see how virtually unchanged that is from when they filmed it, however many years ago Gladiator was, and the guy who's standing in the same field today. It looks the same. I mean, it's green in the one picture and kind of brown in the other. But I dare say that's probably exactly how that little valley and hill looked for the last who knows how many thousands of years. Probably looked just the same. So it's interesting. Take a look at it. It's on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. Back to the phones. Let's go to Chelsea, listening in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Good morning, Chelsea.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Hey, I have a question for you about dealing with anger as a Christian. I'm struggling with that right now.
Well, I think you speak for a lot of us. We all have to deal with anger from time to time. So obviously we think in terms of anger as being sinful, and it often is. So wrath is one of the seven deadly sins. So we shouldn't fall into the sin of anger, but there is a form of anger that St. Thomas talks about. We sometimes refer to it as righteous indignation. And that tracks with what it says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, be angry, but do not sin. And do not let the sun go down on your anger. So there are times when anger is necessary and helpful, because without it, you would never actually be roused to do something, say, injustice or in charity to help somebody. You see something that's not right. If it doesn't stir you to some kind of righteous anger, then you'll never do anything about it. That's what St. Thomas talks about. He says that anger is very often a sin, but usually when it's sinful, it's because the anger involves a desire for retribution and to harm the person that you're angry with, as opposed to anger about an injustice or anger at a situation that you have it within your means, in some cases, to remedy. And you're not seeking to destroy the other person or seek retribution, but rather to bring justice into a place where it's lacking. I could go on and just give you anecdotal suggestions, but I would like to recommend that you read St. Thomas's treatise on anger from the Summa, and I have a link to it on my Twitter feed. So I'm going to find it and bump it up to the top by retweeting it, but you can search for it if you go into Twitter and put Patrick Madrid or at Patrick Madrid, and then just type in the word anger, and you'll be able to locate that post. I'll have it up and ready to go at the next break, but you can get it even faster than that. So that's something to consider. So tell me about your anger issue. Are you finding it difficult to forgive somebody, or are you just gritting your teeth because of people you have to deal with, or what's going on?
I'm finding it hard to forgive. I stay at home with my three kids, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to talk about it right now.
It's okay. I understand. Do you have somebody in your life that you can talk to about it with, your husband or a friend or somebody that you could really open up to?
You bet.
Good. Okay. Well, just know, I'm sorry, what was that, Chelsea?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going on a date night with my husband tonight, so good. Hopefully it'll be a good,
Good. Well, I will pray that that is just what you need. Sometimes it just takes the opportunity to talk it out and just get the words out and have a chance. It's almost like having a good cry sometimes. You know, you just have to get it all out. And then once you do, you feel better.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We'll get that resource.
All right. God bless you, Chelsea. Hang in there, and I'm always here for you, okay? Anytime you want to call, give me a call and we'll talk. Thank you. Let's go now to David in Chicago. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Patrick. A couple of weeks ago, it was a Monday morning, you spent about an hour talking about UFOs.
Yes.
And the following morning, there was residual talk for about maybe 20 minutes. And then the end of the week, Drew Mariani spoke.
Never heard of him.
For about a half an hour. And I'm wondering, was there a story or something in the New York Times? Because you seem to have been pretty intrigued by it, and I'm wondering what's going on, because I have heard the Pentagon was supposed to release that dossier today that was declassified, and I'm wondering if you've read anything in the papers. I didn't get the New York Times yet or the Chicago Tribune or downloaded.
Right. Yeah, so at the beginning of the month, there was a spate of UFO-related stories that had sort of spiked in the media. And so I began talking about it in early, well, it was actually really late May. So probably about the middle or the end of late May, I started to discuss it, talked about UFO sightings as covered by 60 Minutes. I talked about what President Obama said about his knowledge of UFOs. We went into the Pentagon releasing video and showing examples, you know, of these craft that we just really couldn't understand. And then it got to the point where the government said it was going to release a report on what it thought the UFO thing was. And that was reported in the New York Times, and I believe I covered it on June the 3rd, if I'm not mistaken. And that particular article said that the government says, we don't know what it is, which was a hugely dissatisfying answer. Because if they don't know what it is, on the one hand, or in subsequent reports, they were saying, we don't know what it is, but we know it's not UFOs, which I didn't really think was that satisfactory of an answer. The only thing I can think of to your question is that this, maybe they know that this is equipment from Russia or China, or maybe it's our own equipment and they're just playing dumb and pretending like they don't really know. But in any case, when that final report came out, they documented all these examples, and then they just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, we don't really know what it is. So for me, that was a real letdown, but that's where things stand as far as I'm aware.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there was a story about the, you know, the Navy and the Air Force. The Air Force fouled them, and they couldn't keep up. And they dive bombed into the ocean, and they've been clocked at 100 knots an hour.
I saw that video.
This is something that was leaked, and it's been all over the place. And I'm just wondering, you know, heavens, what's going on?
I know. And, you know, these things are not, they're not sporadic. This seems to be a constant phenomenon where these craft are sighted on a regular basis by airline pilots, by naval ships, by people in their backyards watching these things go overhead. And it's not just in a particular place. It seems to be widespread. So clearly something is happening. I have no doubt of that. Whether this is conventional, you know, conventional craft that are developed by one of the superpowers, that's one option. Another possibility is that it is from another civilization that's not from Earth. That's possible. Some people argue that these are demons masquerading as flying around in spaceships. I don't personally find that view persuasive, but that's another theory that's propounded out there. But in the end, I really don't know what it is, and I'd like to know what it is. You know what I'm saying?
Interesting, though. It's interesting it came in our lifetime in the 21st century, you know, now. Stay tuned, the jury's out.
Yeah, well, if something happens, I will bring it to you, David. I promise you that. It's, you know, I'm not a sci-fi guy in terms of my, you know, I'm not riveted onto that topic. But clearly this is something worthy of our attention, especially if it might suggest that there is a hostile power that would attack us with the superior technology. I don't like the sound of that at all. So I'll keep you posted. I promise you that. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Barbara, listening in Monterey County, California. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Patrick. I first of all want to say thank you for your part in helping me come into the church 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
After a lifelong...
Welcome home.
A lifelong Protestantism. Thank you. It's been a blessing. I am now retired, but I used to listen to you just religiously on the way to work every day. And remember your, and I think it was Tim Staples?
Yeah, Tim Staples.
Talking about, yes, the apologetics, and that really helped me convert from Protestantism. But my question today is I have heard you, I think it was you, talk about how if your children are doing something that is contrary to church teaching, that we should not participate in it. And I think your teaching was mostly related to like going to weddings. But okay. My children, my I have three children, the youngest is 38. They've all been in a situation of cohabitation. One of them is married, but my husband and I, my husband's also Catholic, have said, we love you, we want to see you, we want to have a relationship with you, but mm-hmm. we will not go to the home that you have established in outside of marriage.
Right.
And this has, this stand has, and the reason we said, we just said we feel like that would be giving a blessing to something we don't believe in, and it would mm-hmm. make us hypocrites. Well, that has really hurt and alienated my children. Two of them are still in contact with me, but there's a lot of anger. The other one is out of contact with me. So my question is, not sure how to deal with that personally, and mm-hmm. also how to communicate to them in a logical way what my stand is. I just had a conversation with my youngest son, who is 38, and he is married now, but he's still hurt and angry about this. And he said, that's not what Jesus would do. It's not loving. It's not kind. And I just kind of at my wits, emotional, mm-hmm. and how to deal with that.
Yeah, I hear your, I hear the pain in your voice. Well, one thing to remind your son is, remember that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 18, he says, if you have something against your brother, go to him in private, see if you can win him over, and hopefully you can. But if you can't, then take two or three witnesses. And if that doesn't work, then tell it to the church. And he says, and if he won't listen even to the church, then treat him as a Gentile or a tax collector. Now, let's just camp out on that for a minute. That means, basically, cut that person off. So this is one of those hard sayings of the gospel, and there are many that are like this, where Jesus basically says, if this person is causing such disruption, and it gets to the point where nothing seems to work, and you've tried everything, and even the church has said this, and he won't listen, then basically cut that person off. Treat him as a Gentile or a tax collector. Now, that's language that the Jews, would understand as meaning have nothing to do with this person. So there is a kind of Pollyanna-ish notion that many people have, that Jesus never said anything that might be perceived as, you know, like you said, that your son thinks that Jesus would never do that. Well, Jesus said to do that in that particular place. So we try to juxtapose those hard sayings of the gospel with other things, like the fact that Jesus went into the homes of tax collectors and Pharisees, sinners, public sinners even in some cases. He let the woman who was who had a very sinful life wash his feet with her tears and anoint them with that special perfume. And that was scandalous to people because you're letting a sinner touch you. You're cavorting with sinners. And, of course, Jesus did this as a way to win them over. So yeah. Here are my thoughts on your particular situation, Barbara. On the one hand, you're right in terms of you're standing up for what is true and you've taught your children the right way. It's they who have departed from it, not you. They are the ones who bear the responsibility, or at least the daughter or son who's doing this in particular. They have the responsibility before God for their own sins. You don't. You're not the cause of it. You're reacting to it, but you're not the cause of it. And it seems that in this dynamic, what has happened is they've turned you into the cause of the problem and are not taking responsibility for their own actions. So objectively speaking, it sounds like that's what's going on here. But subjectively, how do you deal with that? Well, I think there's room here for you to go after them or pursue them in a way that might involve, you know, you're coming to their house for a meal. Now, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with eating a meal in somebody's home if the person is a sinner. Example, Jesus. He went into the homes of sinners and he ate with them. He broke bread with them. So if you take that as a cue, I think there's at least some latitude here for you to relax that restriction and say, you know what? Okay, sure. I want to have a relationship with you. And then go and eat with them as Jesus did with those sinners. Keep those lines of communication open. Now, if they said, hey, we'd like to go on a vacation or we'd like to come and visit you and we want to stay together in this bedroom, then you're, I think, well within your rights, and even it would be necessary to say, no, we're not going to do that, because then you would be directly condoning or participating at a remote level in somebody's sinful activity. So I'm not suggesting you should eliminate all barriers or all restrictions, but eating at their home, I don't think falls into that category. I think eating at their home okay. shows your willingness to pursue them because you love them. You know, you're not going to give into everything, but this is one thing where there is some room to maneuver, you know, and it keeps okay, that yeah, line so of communication open.
Providing for it, yeah. Providing for it would be one thing, and absolutely we wouldn't do that. But
yeah, if you were to say, you know what, we're going to buy your bedroom furniture for you. No, I mean, that's obviously yeah. contributing to the problem. But if you say, hey, you want to have us over for lunch? Okay, we'll come over for lunch. I think that's reasonable.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I guess maybe I extrapolated a little bit extremely from the not attending the wedding mm-hmm. of a child or son that's outside the faith. And
I think that's the right thing to do. I think that's the right thing to do. I mean, I know people who say, well, listen, they're your children, you love them, and just for the sake of family togetherness, go ahead and go and celebrate. I have a hard time imagining that St. John the Baptist would have gone to the wedding, quote unquote, of King Herod and his brother's wife, you know, just for the sake of keeping the lines of communication open. I have a hard time imagining that St. John the Baptist would just show up at the wedding reception and pretend as though everything was okay. I mean, he actually lost his head over this issue because he was speaking out against right. what was going on.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I did have a conversation with a priest and when this all came up, and he said, no, you're right. So I guess it's that my husband and I were right in not going to the home. And so now, you know, that's you're saying there's something different, and it's just not, either way is not sitting right with me. It's yeah. very confusing.
I understand. Well, do what you know is right. And all I can say is I think in this case, eating a meal with them would not infringe upon, it would not cause you to compromise if you ate a meal with them. Thanks a lot. Hang in there. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Real life solutions you can believe in. Yeah! The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah! We're going to California, we're going to South Dakota, and Texas, and New York, and Texas, and New York. Yeah!
Play it. Play it. Little known fact.
And Oregon and Washington. We're going to South Dakota. We're going to South Dakota. And Michigan. And Michigan.
It's a little known fact. That is Drew Mariani screaming. We had him go into the studio. And we had him redo the Howard Dean scream. That's actually Drew Mariani. Play that scream again, Cyrus.
Yes, that's true.
Yes, that's true. I'm playing bass. There we go. I talked over it. That is Drew Mariani, isn't it? That scream? I think when he knows there's Italian
yes,
food on the menu.
True.
Okay. That's the story I'm sticking with. Let's go to Tony in Murrieta, California. Hi, Tony. Hello, Tony. Okay. Let's go to David in the Twin Cities. Hi, David. You are on the air.
Hi, Patrick.
Are you ready for your close-up? You're on the air. Okay,
yep,
welcome.
Yep, thank you. So I'm a devout Catholic, but for my question, I'm trying to steel man an argument. It's just easier for me to ask it to you in the other person's okay. point of view. So okay. What would you say to the origins of the Bible, with relation to the origins of the Bible, that this is something that has been, in lack of a better word, crafted over centuries until it was written in the 300 or 400s. It's been crafted over the centuries that aligns with their tradition. Obviously, there's no belief that it was supernaturally inspired, but it's just the position that, like, hey, listen, you have this book. I grant it to you, but this book came out of your tradition. It came out of, you know,
okay.
You guys had hundreds of years to craft this, and your doctrines align with it, because of course it would. It is the archer that, you know, builds a bullseye after he shoots the arrow, if you will. How do you respond to that concept?
Now, when you said that, it made me think you were speaking about the New Testament specifically. Is that what you're talking about, or the person telling you this? Or are you talking about the whole Bible, including the Old Testament?
I'm not even that nuanced. I guess maybe whatever. I guess you're a little bit ahead of me even more. But maybe say the New Testament, because that's obviously going to be a sure.
Okay, so let's take the New Testament.
If it's easier for you to talk to it as older versus new, whatever you want to do, whatever you want.
Okay, fair enough. So let's take that scenario. Let's just operate with the New Testament for now. So the claim is, this is something that you have crafted. I think you said that he said that this is from the 400s or something like that. Did he actually say that the Bible goes back to the 400s?
Well, just his main point was just that a Bible is something that got crafted out of the tradition. You know, it didn't just fall at year 30 AD or whatever. It was a document that has had centuries and centuries of crafting by their position, by the Christian position. So, of course, it's going to line up with what the church teaches, or, for lack of a better word, just trying to be simplistic.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start there, David. I would say, yeah, that's right. What about it? So here's what you need to do. You need to learn some rhetorical jujitsu moves, and this is one of them, okay? Because the person's expecting you to deny it and backpedal and try to disprove it. And quite frankly, that statement is in fact true. So you'd say, yeah, that's right. What about it? Now, that's going to put the other person kind of off balance for a minute, because he's not expecting you to say that. So then he has to sort of say...
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
Right. So, okay, let's pause there then and analyze this. So the New Testament is, I mean, he's using the word crafting. I think by crafting, what he means is that it was written in such a way as to promote views that may or may not even be true, but it's a way to be persuasive in getting people to buy into your theories as Christians. And that's true. It's true. It also is. It is the written version, or the amount that was set down in writing, of the oral tradition of the church. So St. Luke talks about that in Luke chapter 1. He talks about how he had interviewed and talked to the eyewitnesses of the people who were telling the story of Jesus verbally, and he made sure that he had all of his details down so he could give a chronological overview in this gospel. For you, most excellent Theophilus, he says. So there's an example. St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, he says, I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold fast to the traditions just as I handed them on to you. So there he's referring to the oral tradition, the oral teaching, the unwritten tradition that he was teaching to the Corinthian church. And now he's beginning the first of two epistles to kind of codify some of what he told them verbally. Not all of that is contained in 1st and 2nd Corinthians, but so the reason I'm pausing here is to show you have nothing to fear from saying, yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. This is the written version of the traditions that were being taught by the apostles, and thank God they were written down so they could become more portable, etc. So now you've done that. So now you've said, okay, that's right. What about it? So he's now rocked back on his heels because it's not what he's expecting. So then he has to say, well, then why would you even follow that? And I'd say, because it's true. You see, what I'm proposing that you do, David, is don't give him what he wants. He wants you to scramble. He wants you to backpedal. He wants you to be on the defensive. Mm-hmm. Don't give him that. And it's mm-hmm. convenient because his premise is actually true. So now what's going to happen if you do this is now he's going to have to defend his premise, which is there's some reason that you shouldn't accept these teachings to be true. And now the burden of proof is on his shoulders, which is where it belongs. It's not on your shoulders. It's on his shoulders. And then let him and let him thrash and kick and fight his way out of that paper bag and make his case. And then now you're in the driver's seat because you're simply then asking questions. Well, if that's true, how do you know that's true? What's your evidence for that? You see, now you're in the driver's seat and you're directing the conversation.
Have you heard of a strong response? Thank you very much, by that way. Have you heard of a strong response to this? Like, I'm trying to even think what a potential counter would be. Like, heard anything strong?
Well, here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. There's no need to counter it because it's true. There's no need to defend against that statement. It's true. It's a true statement. He thinks it damages your position. But that just shows that he's somewhat ignorant and doesn't really understand the dynamics here. So by your saying, that's right, what about it? He now has to scramble. He's the one who has to scramble, not you.
Yeah. Brilliant. And on a related note, I was listening to Dr. David Anders yesterday on called the Communion Show. I really like him as well. It's fantastic. He's something that I haven't heard. The Gospel of John, that scholars believe the Gospel of John may not have been actually written by John, but by others. And that's somewhat true with all the gospel writers, because you have a Q source and whatever other sources. But how do you answer that thing as well? Like that these things actually weren't written by Luke or by John or whatever.
Right. So there are people who have done a really good job of that, like Father William Most, and I would recommend his book called Free from All Error, because he does shoot that down. He has another book called Catholic Apologetics Today. He has a whole chapter on the topic of things like, did Luke really write Luke, and how do we know? One thing is for sure that the Gospels are all anonymous. They don't tell us in the Gospels who wrote them. There are clues that we can deduce the authorship, but primarily we go on the basis of the testimony of the Church, because the Church vouchsafes for us the certitude of the authorship of the four Gospels, not to mention some of the other epistles in the New Testament that are also anonymous. So that's where we go for our certitude, but that has plenty of documentary evidence to support that. I'd recommend a book to you. It's another book to you. It's called Where We Got the Bible, Our Debt to the Catholic Church, and that's by Father, or Bishop, I guess, Henry Graham. Anyway, I'll leave it at that, David. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you. Let's go now to Tony in Murrieta. We'll try to get Tony back on the air. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Patrick. My question is, can parents consecrate the suffering of their children who are under the age of reason?
Now, when you say consecrate, what do you mean by that exactly?
Basically just to offer up their sufferings in the same way that, you know, we would encounter something that would cause suffering with us, and we would offer that up to God.
So yes, you can. And it would be you as dad, who are asking God to use the suffering that your child is experiencing for his or her benefit, you know, growth in holiness, that kind of thing. It is different than you offering your own suffering, because obviously you're the one who's offering that intention and it's your suffering. But I don't think that there's any reason why you couldn't ask God to accept the meritorious aspect of another person's suffering, especially if the child is below the age of reason and can't make that kind of an act of consecration himself. You know, you as dad can do that.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a little one suffering right now?
Not at the moment. I'm about to have 4 kids under 4 years old next month, and almost all of them but one have been in the NICU. And it's just a tremendous amount of suffering for us, and I can only imagine what, you know, my infant child is going through. And it's just a lot of, like, such a pure soul. Yeah. You know, I would imagine that would be extremely meritorious for their souls in the long run.
You know, one of the saving graces in this situation, Tony, is that a little baby that age in the NICU, so a preemie who's, let's say, 2 months early or a month early, I had two grandsons who were preemies and were in the NICU. One of my grandsons was in the NICU for 3 months. So when we would go and visit him, I know exactly what you're talking about, that kind of anguish that the parents go through. But here's the saving grace, if you ask me. Those little babies don't have any concept of time. They're not thinking about tomorrow. They're not thinking about, gee, I've been here for a week. For them, this is part of what eases their suffering. And that is they don't comprehend it. They're not thinking about it the way you would think about it if you were laid up in a hospital bed kind of thing. So I think that should help assuage some of your anguish as a parent when you see your child in that situation. We want to do everything to relieve their suffering, but it's nice to know, it's good to know, it's comforting to know, I think, that the children are not suffering at a deeper level the way you and I would, because we understand time and meaning and things like that.
Awesome.
Anyway, Tony, thank you. And Godspeed to you, sir. 4 children. What a great gift God has given you and your wife. And I hope that you all have many happy years together, Tony. Thank you. Well, that's it for me. I was going to try to get to another call, but the music says we can't. So we'll do it again soon. And until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.